what happened is that Rihanna's assistant spoke to her. She gifted it to Rihanna. And one day I woke up and she was wearing it. And that's sort of how it grew up. Seriously. Dude, I just got really lucky. Honestly, I didn't do anything.
Hello and welcome to Clicked Off. Every week we'll be hearing from the people making it big in e-commerce. I'm your host, Jason Chappell. So today I have got joining me Neil Sada. Neil is co-founder of numerous D2C brands, and he has started FlexChain a little over a year ago, Neil. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been a year and a half ago now.
Okay, a year and a half ago. You've also been involved in various street brands that have been worn by some mega celebrities, right? Rihanna, LeBron,
Beyonce, Kanye West, the Kardashians, like quite a few A-listers in LA.
And I mean, let's jump straight in there. What was the brand and how did you get it in these celebrities' hands?
Okay, cool. Well, the name of the brand is NASA Seasons. You can look it up online. We got quite famous because we were making caps with messages that used to say, "I came to break hearts," or "Almost Famous," and other ones. And dude, I just got really lucky. Honestly, I didn't do anything. Like, the way it happened is that we started the brand as sort of a high school project. We're making hats for our parties. And I mean, we did got the shop called Colette in Paris, which was a very famous concept store. I mean, it's the store that sort of initiated what concept stores are. And they accepted to sort to sell some of our caps. They bought initially, I think it was 21 or 25 caps. So it was very small. And what happened is that Rihanna's assistant bought the hat. She gifted it to Rihanna. And one day I woke up and she was wearing it. And that's sort of how it grew up. Seriously. And I'll tell you something funny. Like, we got an incredible amount of celebrities and influencer placement. And I'd say, honestly, 95 to 98% of them were all fully organic, meaning they just bought it. There were even moments where we're like, there's more celebrities than customers buying it. There's all things So to tell you honestly, like, we got just really, really lucky.
Oh my God. Well, look, I've invited you on because I met you at an event recently, and you were doing a bit of a talk about manufacturing and supply chain and those sorts of things. And I think this is such a big thing for the audience, for everybody in e-commerce. And it's something that doesn't get talked about as often as other parts of e-commerce, because it's just, I don't think, seen as, it's not as sexy as ads. It's not, as glamorous as some of the other areas. But there's so much money to be had here and so much opportunity. So this is where FlexChain came in, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the way pretty much it started is that I've co-founded a lot of D2C brands, mainly in textile. And the funny thing is that every brand I've had this sort of, same manufacturing issues, from very expensive prices to always being sort of you're never fully aligned with the factory. There's always an issue with the quantities, the quality, or something like this. Communication is terrible. You have to fly there. It's a pain. It's very expensive to stay there. And at the end of it, it never really works out perfectly. But you're like, you know what? It sort of works. So we'll keep it this way. We won't touch it. But, it's very scary and it's always a problem. And the funny thing is also, I've realized one thing is that every time we're meeting these people, the cultural fit was so bad. There was such a mismatch in understanding of what we were doing and what they were doing that it was just like the communication was always extremely hard. From under-promising to over-promising to just people not understanding our vision and what we were trying to do. So after creating my last D2C brand, which was actually a period underwear company in Africa, which is a whole different story by itself, I sort of had, because of this brand, I had to live in Egypt, where we're doing manufacturing, and I've sort of started to understand how it worked and how we could actually manufacture for brands quite, you know, in a much more efficient, much more cost-efficient way too, and much better way overall. And from this, we got introduced to our first customer, which was a period underwear company in France. So same product, same sort of brand. I got on really well with the founder, sort of convinced him to start manufacturing for his brand, which is actually the leading brand in France. And that's how the company started, pretty much.
Wow. So it came out of you running a brand and coming up against challenges in that supply chain, in that manufacturing process, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't, you know, sort of funnily enough, I've actually never worked in China. I guess I'm one of the rare guys who is on e-commerce from other countries. So I've done manufacturing in the US, done manufacturing in France, I've done manufacturing in Portugal, in Morocco, even in, at one point we were, I think, in Bolivia or something like this. So I've done a lot of countries, but I've never worked in China. But the main reason that I was always sort of scared from it, because it's very far, and one time I tried and it was really bad. So I was like, I'm never going to do it again. And so I've always worked from different countries, and I've always seen the same issues. So it's years of problems that culminated in creating one solution for everyone, which is actually at the end of it, quite straightforward. What we do is pretty much, you know, at the end of it, what we do is something that already exists. We are in some way a sourcing agent. However, the main difference is that we work in a completely different way as a traditional sourcing agent, who is going to basically buy your product FOB from a factory. So he's basically, you know, you're going to come to the sourcing agent. He's going to just go to one of the factories that he knows, get the price for it, going to get quoted $2 for it. He's going to quote it back to you for $3 or $2.50, and then you buy it or whatever, and that's it. The way we worked is quite different in the sense that, one, as like ex-brand owners, I work and comes in the sense that we want to reduce cost and we want to increase quality. And for that, the solution that we found was that if you work with manufacturers on a CMT basis, which is called a cut, manufacture, and trim, meaning that we only work with an assembler who assemble the product, and then we go and source every raw materials ourselves, meaning that we cut every other middleman in the equation, and that we can choose the fabric more easily, we can get better prices on them, and also that we lead the whole buying process with locals from the industry, from the same country as the factories and other, we're able usually to reduce the manufacturing cost of pretty much any textile product on the market by 30 to 50%, and even more sometimes. It's quite crazy. While increasing the quality. Yeah, so I'll give you an example. For period underwear, the rough manufacturing price of a period underwear in Morocco, which is one of the biggest countries where people make it for European brands, is around 5 to 7 euros a piece. In Turkey, it's around 4 to 6 euros. In China, it's around 3 euros to 5. In Egypt, when we do it, it's from €1.80 to €3.50. So we're much, much, much lower. And which makes it that I'm in a business where I make money, my customer make money, the factory makes money, and everyone makes a lot more money, because we're just being very reasonable people. We're betting on volume and not betting on small orders. And so that's sort of our, you know, philosophy of working. The way we price it to customers there is very simple. We charge them 12% of the COGS. So let's say you buy an underwear from us for €1, we'll sell it to you for €1.12. And that makes it that I think it's pretty reasonable. And within that sort of commission, what we do is that we do obviously the orchestration layer. So we source everything for you. We make sure it's perfect. We get the certificate, the whole thing. We also have a quality control team within the assembler, because we don't trust anyone. That's sort of our motto within our company. So that we literally have our own guys on the line, making sure that everything is perfect for you, that the product is assembled the right way, that there's not going to be any issue, but it's all good. And at the end of it, we obviously expect it to you, send it to you, and make sure it's all perfect and what you expect it to be. So we literally do all of that for 12% of the COGS. And as of right now, our customers have been very happy. And I guess our biggest issue has been that it's hard to convince brand owners that you can get better prices while maintaining standards or getting even better.
I mean, that it seems counterintuitive, right? You would logically, you would assume that a lower price is going to mean lower quality by and large. But what you're saying is the quality doesn't change. In fact, the quality can improve because you have greater control over that whole manufacturing process rather than just outsourcing the whole piece.
It's important to remember that like the textile manufacturing industry is for me one of the least technologized industry in the world, one of the least efficient. In the sense that it's not because you work with a factory owner who has 3,000 employees who is out here making sure everything is perfect, but the fabric is going to source for you is going to be the best at the best price. Don't expect that at all. And actually, I think usually in that case, these people are so busy managing the lines and managing the workers and the 5 million issues they have, which is really the case, that they're actually usually less good than, you know, recruiting a sole trader somewhere that's going to do the job of like just finding, you know, some cotton for you in the country where you manufacture it. So that's why I think by increasing control, you just get better prices just because you cut everyone. And I have a lot of good examples on this, you know, a lot. Like one of them is, for example, when we first, you know, started investigating how they manufacture pure underwear in Morocco, one of the key ingredients of the underwear is bamboo fabric. And we thought that the guy was buying bamboo fabric directly from the supplier. Well, no, you know, guess what? He was buying it from a guy in France, was buying it from a guy in Spain, was buying it from a guy in China. And every time we were asking about, you know, what's the actual origin of the fabric? What's the actual composition? You know, getting a bit more information about the prices, the consumptions, all of that, we were either like insulted or, you know, people stopped answering us because there's just so many people just taking commissions along the way.
Now, you advocate quite strongly for more localized sourcing, don't you? You know, Well, I think there's a big assumption that in order to get the best price or something like that, that everybody has to go to China. And I hear lots of stories about people just jumping online and either like Googling it or going to Alibaba or things like that. And that's fine. That can work. People can find solutions that way. But then there's the additional shipping cost and time and all those sorts of things. Now, you spoke or have spoken about bringing that a lot closer to home, you know, a lot closer to the countries where you are going to actually, you know, sell this product. How does that work?
Look, I think by default, I'm extremely paranoid as a guy, meaning that I always expect that something's going to get, you know, problematic along the way. And so I think China is still very good for a few stuff, meaning if you want to start a brand very quickly and, you know, you want to do drop shipping, or maybe you're just Apple and you can afford something incredible in China, then it's probably the best thing for you. If you're somewhere in the middle of this, you have a brand that's growing, or you want to be in something, you know, that's a bit more long-lasting with quality and stuff, I would always advise you to like just check whatever is around your customer, because it's going to be much less of a headache. It's going to be much easier for you to control it. And at the end of it, you know, sort of my secret sauce for making, you know, textile manufacturing works efficiently is just by being there. By being there, you're able to, you know, cut lead times because you're out here and you can go check the factories every single day if you can. You can talk to the people there. You can understand what's the holdup, what's the issues, how does the pricing works, what's the issue with the assembling side of it, because maybe it's really hard to make and you want to, you know, change a little fix to make it easier for people. And two, at the end of it, you know, a big side of my job is just like calling up people and be like, did you start working by order or is it finished? And by being able to do that pretty much at least, you know, twice a week and then showing up there and making sure it's perfect, things just move on quite quickly, you know, quite efficiently. And so by default, not even taking consideration shipping, you know, saving the earth and all of that, it's just so much more efficient to do it as close as possible to your customers. That's why, you know, a lot of the big companies are trying to like do the whole reshoring stuff, especially in the States, because if you take in consideration what I just said, plus then you had shipping time, you had the risk of China with COVID and everything that happened. You had the fact that you might have communication issues. You had the fact that it might be, you know, very complicated if you want to change something last minute and the guy, you know, there's time zone difference and all of that, and you made a payment and the payment is already there and it doesn't reply it since then. All of these things make it that if I was going to manufacture, like sell my product in the US or in Europe or anything like that, I'd look probably either at Mexico in the States or even just California as a starting point where it worked in the past. Or if you're in Europe, I'd look at North Africa or Eastern Europe or Portugal, maybe if you want to do something very high end. But that's sort of my way of thinking about it. So I'd say, like, first is be as close as possible to your customers. To check out then obviously the logistics cost, how much it costs to ship it by boat or by plane. And sort of also the secret sauce that no one speaks about is free trade agreements. You know, are you going to manufacture in a country where when are you going to ship it to your customers, you're going to get 20-30% taxes on arrival because your country where you manufacture has a, you know, a trade war with your country where most of your customers are? I mean, that's information that is not too hard to obtain, but you still have to investigate it. And that can create major surprises on arrival. So if you work in countries that have special agreement, like Egypt, for example, the US or Europe, it just makes it so much easier. When I ship, there's no custom taxes. It takes a day. It's so smooth. It's so easy because it's just the system has been made for that.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And I would imagine one that's often overlooked, right? But this isn't just for like big brands. It's not for the Apples and the Nikes of the world. Smaller brands can get in on this too, right?
Yeah, 100%. I think actually it's better for smaller brands than big, big brands. Because, so one thing I've learned that's quite interesting is the way, you know, Zara, H&M works and all of that. These guys, they're so big, but actually they don't even take care of sourcing materials anymore because they don't want to mess, you know, they don't want to spend their time on that. What they do is that they work with their suppliers and they say, we want this at this price in 2 weeks. And the supplier is going to say yes, because obviously you don't want to say no to Zara because that's a life-changing deal for you. Mm-hmm. So they're in the position where we can demand stuff from people. If you're a small brand doing it, say, from €1 million or pound or dollars in revenue all the way up to, I'd say, you know, 30, 50 million in revenue, I'd say go do that sourcing. If you're a very small brand, like sub 1 million in revenue, I'd say you can do it, but it's going to be harder because you're going to get minimum quantities on fabrics. So you'll have to take a bit more of a bigger risk, but you can still afford to do it, especially in countries like Portugal, in countries like, you know, the US and stuff like that, where manufacturers are going to be much more keen on helping you and making sure that you can do that project properly. And then it's pretty simple, man. You get a car, you rent it, you make your shopping list. I don't know, you want to buy 50 zippers, 50, you know, kilogram of cotton, whatever. And you just find these manufacturers, assemblers, and you go one by one. And you just buy it, you buy everything, you relate it in the warehouse, you give it to the assembler, and you're like, just make my product, and that's it. And it's very simple for everyone.
And is there somewhere where people can go to find manufacturers, or is it just a case of like getting your Google skills out and hitting the keyboard?
It's very hard. It's very hard. And I hope one day I'll be able to solve that problem, but it's really hard. China has an incredible tool. They have Alibaba, which makes it so much easier for everyone to find anything. Unfortunately, for the rest of the world, we pretty much have nothing. When I moved to Egypt, the way I did it is that I called the Ministry of Commerce. So it was really old school. And basically, after I called them, they did not believe I was going to come. But I told them, I'm coming tomorrow. I took a flight. I drove there. I spoke to a guy who gave me the number of like three random factories. I went there. I explained to them what I wanted to do. They introduced me to a bit more guys and step by step started growing a network. But that work by itself took me more than a year. So that was really hard. So that's why what I'm doing right now is being able to sort of give all these contacts, relationship that were built during this, you know, these years now, and leverage them to his, you know, to anyone who wants to manufacture in Egypt.
Nice. And so you've gone out and you've found these people and you've sourced so much and you've done so much legwork. Are there mistakes that brands are making on a daily basis that you can help them with straight away, or that there's advice that's, you know, you can give them that just say, okay, I see everybody doing this, stop doing it?
Well, the first advice I want to give is you have to go there. Obviously, that's like an obvious for me. Starting a brand and never visiting your manufacturer and just, you know, do a first order, test it out and whatever, it's never going to work in the long term. You have to go there. So no matter where you want to do it, just go there. Even if it's China, just go there and see, check it out, talk to them, meet the people, whatever. The second thing is what I see a lot of brands doing and, you know, messing up on is that they want to manufacture with, you know, a star factory. They want to manufacture with the guys doing the manufacturing for Nike, for Calvin Klein and whatever, because they think that, you know, because they're doing that, they must be incredible. True, you know, they are pretty good. But what happens all the time is that you're going to be the worst customer out of the amazing customers. And just as, you know, simple business logic, if you're going to bring a factory, you know, $10,000 in profit, because they make really small profits, you have to remember that. They have a lot of people to pay, it's a lot of work. So you can bring them $10,000 in profit. What they're working with Calvin Klein was bringing them $3 million a year. Obviously, if there's anything that's going to happen with you guys, is, you know, it's going to be the least priority of everyone involved.
Minimum order quantities. Let's talk about minimum order quantities, because I think a lot of brands, this is a big issue for them at the beginning. Like, how do they predict how much stock they're going to sell? That's a how long's a piece of string question, right? Because who knows? They could end up with their product in Rihanna or Beyonce's hands and be onto something, you know, early doors. Or actually, they might be sitting on a ton of stock for a long period of time because they just don't have the traction that they were hoping for. But they've had to order a certain amount of stock. What's the best thing that brands can do in terms of making sure that they're meeting a minimum order quantity with a manufacturer, but also that it's something that they can cope with?
Look, I think if it's going to be your first order, don't expect to make a profit or expect to make a very small profit as a brand, because no matter what, you know, you don't know anything about your brand yet. That means cost acquisition. And I mean, you're the guy, you know, who knows that really well. They're going to be very expensive in the beginning. Patient, you know, you have to do it step by step. You're probably going to get some product returns. You're probably going to have some issues. You're going to pay your first influencers. Obviously, no one knows you. You're going to pay a lot of money for that. I mean, everything is going to be expensive, including manufacturing. So I'd say when you start, you want to go with the lowest MOQ as possible. And even if that means like you're going to pay a higher price, just go with the lowest MOQ. Because at the end of it, what you need is one, a great product. So you're going to take the time to do it properly. And you want to do a small MOQ, as I said before. So if you do and you try to, you know, go and make 200 pieces and push it hard and whatever, I mean, nobody's going to make money on the manufacturing side of it. So obviously you're going to get a pretty terrible product because no one's going to put the effort to do something good because they simply won't make any money. And when I say won't make any money, some of them might even lose money on working with you. And you'd say, how? I'd say, because the time people are going to spend, you know, assembling the thing is going to be higher than the amount of money they make. And you're going to have to do a lot of return or whatever. And so they're going to end up, you know, the people are going to end up costing more than the product itself. And so the owner is going to lose money on it. So I'd say, just go with the lowest MOQ as possible. Don't really bother about how much you're going to pay. Obviously, it needs to be reasonable, but whatever. And just get that right. When this is right and you've start, you know, you've sold all of that first order, then you can, you know, call me and we can do something serious and work with, you know, small MOQs that are reasonable enough so everyone can benefit from them. And that, I'd say, I mean, in terms of textile, you know, something like 2,000 pieces 1,500 pieces is probably going to be the minimum you're going to want to work with if you want to start working on reducing your cost. And that's really the bare minimum. Anything under is going to be impossible. Because even if you make 300 pieces and the factory say to you for 10 euros a piece, 10 pounds a piece or whatever, I mean, you know, it's 3K. It's nothing. It's not going to do anything business. So, yeah.
Now, is this something that is kind of the gift that keeps on giving, in the sense that, assuming people are doing well, they are selling their stock, they're making a little bit more money, they're reinvesting in that stock, hopefully their order quantities are going up because they're, you know, they're doing well, is it something that you can continually help them with, you know, in terms of those goalposts are moving, you know, all the time in terms of fluctuations in raw material cost and manufacturing cost, and then the actual retail price that's being sold at, quantities, all of these things are moving. Can you, you know, can FlexChain help continually? Is that something that you're monitoring for your clients?
Yeah, all the time. So we do a lot of different stuff regarding that. One thing is that we recently built a sample studio in our office. So we don't outsource samples to factories now, because we realize that factories hate it to do sample work because it takes a very long time for them. They have a lot of stuff to do and they don't make money on it, and it's just a waste. So we actually do, first of all, the whole sampling work within our own office. That makes it that now when customers, you know, want to have new products, we can ship them samples in 24 to 48 hours, which was already a huge plus for them. So some customers will ask for samples. We'll do it for them for free. They'll take the samples, they'll shoot it, they'll take pictures of it, they'll put it on their socials, and they'll see what's the customer reaction from that. And then if the customer love it, they'll order it from us. So that's sort of a win-win relationship that we built with customers. Another thing we do is that we actually even sometimes like create our own product from scratch, and then we propose it to brands. So let's say you have an underwear brand. I bring my team and I tell you, this is what we can do for you. If you're interested, we can do it for you. But how much it costs? We spend some time ourselves working on it. Let me know what you think. And on the other side, regarding the, you know, pricing and logistics and all of it, because we have, you know, quite a few customers now, we pretty much, you know, pull out of the product. It's a lot of, you know, the fabrics coming back again and again, like cotton and stuff like that. So we do buy that on a very regular basis. So we do have the price monitored 24/7. And based on that, what we do is that we also constantly advise brands we work with on fabrics they should be using, because sometimes, you know, they're really stuck on something, when actually you can get the same thing for something that's 30 or 40% cheaper. So that's something we actually do. And we help them on consumptions. Maybe, you know, they made a sweater, you know, in a certain way and they love it. They love the fit. And they think that the fit is amazing because, you know, the fabric they're using has this exact weight. When actually we know it's because the way it was cut makes it look like that. So we'll tell brand, hey, you know, if we reduce the weight, customers will get pretty much the same feeling, and maybe we can change the threads within the fabric and it'll be better. I don't know if we, you know, moisture wicking or anything like that. And it'll, you know, get your price lower than 20%. And people usually are very happy to do that. And what we bet on is that if the price gets lower, they'll make more profit and they'll order us, you know, more stuff at the end. We're really betting on volume. And at the end of it, you know, it's an interesting job, because back in the 70s and 80s, you know, there used to be a lot of people doing what we do. Like sourcing agents used to be a big thing. People became billionaires out of that, you know. And why? It's because all these guys in Britain, the UK, whatever, went to Hong Kong and China in the early 70s, 80s. Obviously, nobody knew about China well. It was really hard to talk to anyone. Communication was catastrophical, so you need an English guy there to check on the stuff for you so that you can even talk to a factory or meet a factory, whatever. And what happened in the early 2000s is that obviously with the rise of the internet, emails, Alibaba, whatever, this sort of, you know, work sort of not died, but there's a lot of very small shops now. It's super highly fragmented. And what happened is that a lot of the brands now try to do it themselves. And so we believe that we can actually do it better, and that by doing things differently is going to help everyone, including the brand, the factories, the earth, like literally everyone involved is going to be happier because there's going to be less waste, less mistakes, better consumption of fabric, better sourcing and all of this. So we believe that building sort of a 2.0 sourcing agent and by technology, obviously we're building a platform for that, and also built by people who have brand owners who share, like, you know, share the same understanding of what a good product is and what building a brand is and how hard it is. We build that. We really believe that this is a huge opportunity for that. There's a huge company to be built out there.
Well, I think this was something that I know when we first spoke, I said to you, I just don't think people consider these things. And I think that it seems out of reach for a lot of brands because they feel at the mercy of just being able to find a manufacturer and then go there and pick from the choices they're given. Whereas you're saying, well, let's make this way more granular. Let's break it down into its component parts and reassemble it in the way it's being packaged up, you know, by the manufacturers. But let's take more control of that supply chain. And I think more and more brands will need to do that, you know, as time goes on. And I think, you know, with the rise of everybody's awareness about the impact on the environment and those sorts of things, and also supporting people closer to home, businesses closer to home, communities closer to home, being able to reinvest much more locally, you know, and Europe and North Africa, we've got a bit of a candy store there in the sense that we're all so close to each other and we can share products, knowledge, you name it, you know, logistics. It's so easy in that respect. Whereas when we look at places like China and America, and all of a sudden it's so much further afield and so much more difficult to get hold of product, just in terms of time and, you know, the impact that it has environmentally. I think a lot more brands want to be aware of the impact they're having on the world, you know, from an environmental standpoint, from a humanitarian standpoint. You know, I think as consumers, we're probably a lot more aware of, you know, the working conditions and living conditions of people in the manufacturing, you know, industries. And we're probably prepared to pay a little bit more if we think that, you know, those people have a higher quality of living rather than just the cheapest price, you know, with the crappiest product. Nobody wants that anymore.
I agree. And you know, also, like, I mean, I agree, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate, the cheapest price. You can get incredible price, if not better prices, as we said before, by reshoring if it's done properly. So it can be an ultra win-win situation for pretty much everyone, including the consumer. So that's what I see, and that's what I've been doing, and that's what we work on. And I think, honestly, I agree with you. And sometimes it's shocking, you know, there's brands that I know, I mean, I won't give names, but there's brands in the UK that I know that are like B Corps, and they claim that they're so good and so nice for the environment and whatever. And then, you know, I know the brands well, and I know the founders, and I know they're manufacturing sort of a crappiest factory in China, and they don't even want to take a meeting with us for us to explain them what we do. They're like, we don't care. We love China. No, we love what we do, and that's it. And so I got blocked by the founder of a brand like that a few days ago. it pissed me off. You know, she was on LinkedIn claiming they were B Corp and how cool they were and everything. And so I just commented. I literally said what I just told you on the post, and they blocked me. But it's fine, whatever, you know. One thing I would recommend brand owners is actually just to dig it up, you know, get into the product and understand it. It's not that hard, you know. You can, and I'm talking about textile, but you could apply that to any product pretty much in the world. Just trying to understand, you know, what's the cost of assembly, cost of raw materials, packaging, logistics, all of this, have it on a clean Excel sheet. And from that, you'll see that usually there's a lot of surprises, especially the best moment is when you try to call suppliers and try to ask them the question, you know, the tough questions, you know, what's the actual price of the cargo box? You know, what's the actual price of this elastic, whatever? And when people don't give you straight up answers, there's usually, you know, some guy somewhere making good money on it. So that's where you've got to be careful and think about how you can work differently. And yeah, and then that's it. You know, it's pretty straightforward to understand that you can make economies of scale and that you can create something much better and much more long lasting, because at the end of it, and no offense to growth marketing and, you know, all of the marketing side of the work, I think it's much easier actually in some ways to make, you know, save money on the manufacturing side of it to be able to then reinvest it in that than the other way around. I think, you know, trying to cut your cost on your ads is extremely hard, demands huge investment in content, which are pretty much, you know, hard to pin down and hard to do and quite complex. Whereas like manufacturing is going to be a 6-7 months of hard work, and then you're set for like 6 years, 5 years, you know. And that makes it that then you don't care that much about your CACs rising, and you can obviously get into new marketing channels and have a brand that is growing a lot more.
Well, do you know what? I advocate something very, very similar, because now we're straying into my world, right? Of, okay, how do we acquire customers? How do we convert them? How do we retain them? For me, I talk to lots of brands, and I'm just telling them, like, your customer acquisition cost is your customer acquisition cost. Like, yes, there are tweaks you can make to bring it down or whatever else, but you're at the mercy of the market. You're at the mercy of Meta, Facebook, Google, Instagram,
Apple,
yeah, wherever, you know, wherever you're advertising, you're at the mercy of those people. So actually, don't focus on the cost of that. Let's focus on your targeting. So, okay, let's have a look in like your retention data. Let's have a look who your best customers are and why. And let's start to build our audiences based on that, rather than, oh, let's just target women between this age and this age. Well, okay, that's quite broad. You might get some, you know, some conversion off that, but okay, let's have a look in the people who have bought. Are there similarities, you know, in their behavioral or psychological similarities that we can start to pick out, so that we can say, okay, we're going to stop targeting everybody. We're only going to target these people, and we're happy to pay a higher acquisition cost, the same or higher acquisition cost for these people, because we know they're more profitable. You know, so it's the flip side of you know, what you're talking about, but it's very, very similar in terms of, okay, if you can reduce cost there, well, I can increase sales here. And it's not just about trying to blast everyone with everything. It's like really defining that ideal customer profile. And then you're going to grow way quicker based on that, right? So, okay, I can then look at your data and I can say, okay, these people are worth X amount of dollars to you, and they stay with you for this length of time. You're going to make X amount of money from these people. Well, is that enough? Do you want to grow? Do you want market share? In which case, you can afford to make less money on those people because you can go out and get more. Or do you want to be profitable? You know, in which case you do it the other way, and you can dial up that profitability. But loads of brands don't know where they are. Probably, like in the manufacturing process, they don't know what they're paying for. They just have an end price.
100%. And one brand who did that really, really well, which I think is the case study for what to do, is True Classics. I don't know if you followed a bit the growth they've had. I mean, True Classics is incredible. One, they manufacture in Egypt. So, you know, big validation for my business on my side. But Egypt is a great way to t-shirts. So one, they manufacture in Egypt. So they've been very careful about the way they do stuff and make it. And they decided not to go with China. Two, they've been extremely good, as you said, on media buying, testing. I think we always have like 400 or 600 creatives, like on like hundreds of different sort of personas, audience retargeting, whatever. So they've been in the numbers since the beginning, and that made it that they became, I think they do like $300 million now in revenue, something like this, in 3 or 4 years. And it's insane. it's just pretty incredible. And then in comparison, you see other brands where founders are like gatekeeping pretty much everything because, you know, it works, but they are scared that if they change one thing, everything is going to get destroyed. And that makes it that at the end of it, they don't make money. And, you know, there's the whole plague of the D2C brands that are like impossible to fund because, you know, it's a hard business and whatever. And people don't believe in it anymore. Some people are saying, is it the end of D2C? I mean, you know, I think it's greatly exaggerated. And there's just so many great brands that exist that just don't communicate. And you just got to be careful about where you invest the pennies.
Agreed. Now, Neil, what's next for you, you personally, and you, FlexChain?
Look, I mean, personally, FlexChain, I mean, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but my business is sort of my life, so I'm sort of following whatever the business is going to do. But in terms of growth, so Pablo is working more on to like actually managing the lines and the people here locally. I work more on the sort of customer acquisition side of it and making sure that everything goes the right way on the customer side. So we're currently in the process of actually targeting and onboarding American brands right now, even more than European brands, surprisingly, because, I mean, I don't know if it's a cultural thing or anything like that, but brands in the US are in some ways more eager to reduce the manufacturing costs. And we benefit in Egypt from a great free trade treaty between Egypt, Israel, and the US. So we can ship there for next to nothing. And the US have in some ways, you know, had this whole policy about reshoring, leaving China, going to Mexico, manufacturing in the US locally or anywhere else. So we're trying to talk to people there. So that's one of the big things we're doing. The second thing we're doing right now, and that's also something I'm highly involved, is actually building a great platform for our customers to, one, calculate the consumption of the fabric, two, check up, you know, on the pricing, three, be able to check about the current stage of the manufacturing, like where is it going, what's the current status, so sort of, you know, a bit of a DHL tracking for your production line, and three, at the end of it, also have a clear understanding of how they can reduce costs and how can they can make things much more efficient. In some ways, we're trying to copy and replicate the playbook set by Flexport, which explains our name, FlexChain, Flexport. Flexport, for the ones who doesn't know, is a huge multi-billion dollar company in the US that sort of took the same idea that we had, except they applied it to shipping. And they started in the beginning by creating a, you know, basic sort of freight forwarder in the States where they're reducing shipping costs for the customers. And they sort of built a platform on top of that and became what they are today. So we're trying to sort of replicate the same playbook by being sort of a normal 2.0 sourcing agent today, and in the long term, ideally, build a platform so that brands could get, you know, pricing in a minute just from an idea, get samples in 24 to 48 hours, and then get the manufacturing expedited with, you know, provision that how much they're going to be paying in the current month and where is it going to be and how they're going to get it, you know. So it's sort of the long term plans we have.
Nice. Okay. And Neil, if people want to speak to you, where can they find you?
So they can either send me an email at neil@getflexchain.com. They can go to our website, getflexchain.com. And you know what? Anywhere they can WhatsApp me at +447 477 471 477. Because, you know, we've realized that a lot of people love to be on WhatsApp for everything regarding manufacturing. So I'll just give out my number to people. It's actually even my personal number. So if you want to just call me and talk to me about your manufacturing problem, I'll be out here.
Awesome. Thank you so much for today, Neil. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'm sure there's going to be tons of questions.
Great. Dude, it's been a pleasure too. And thank you so much.
Anybody that does have questions, you can email them to Neil. Or you can send them to me. It's fine. And I'll make sure Neil gets hold of them. But I will put his details in the show notes so anybody can get hold of him if they need.